ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
He imagined infinity and was burned at the stake. He denied Christ's divinity and the Trinity and paid for it with his life. Hi, I'm James Carlton. Welcome to God Forbid on ABC Radio National and a special series of programs on religious rebels, revolutionaries who defied empires and reshaped traditions and changed the world forever. Some you may not know, but once you do, you'll hear their echo around us still. We're telling the story of Giordano Bruno. He's the 16th century heretic from Naples who said the universe was infinite, refused to recant, even on the pain of death. He was a friar and philosopher, an astronomer and astrologer, a master of maths and memory, and he was a poet. And we have a special international God Forbid panel with which to learn more about him. Ingrid Rowland is Professor Emeritus of History at the U.S. University of Notre Dame. Dilwyn Knox is Emeritus Professor of Renaissance Studies at the University College London. And Sean Blanchard is Lecturer in Theology at Notre Dame University, Australia. Ingrid's in Rome, Dilwyn's near Pisa in Italy, and in our Perth studios, Sean, a warm welcome all. Ingrid, to you first. Why does this long-dead man, Giordano Bruno, excite you still?
The way he writes is totally captivating. And so, in fact, what drew me to him was his own writing. I was sitting in the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris waiting for a manuscript, and I thought, I'll just take out a book by Giordano Bruno. And I started reading it, and it was the most fun. He has this over-the-top rhetoric. His ideas are aesthetically beautiful, and he has no respect for most people, great respect for nature and for God, and the combination is completely captivating, so that, in fact, one of the things I do for fun is translate him.
I mentioned he's a poet and a mathematician, so do these books read like maths textbooks or poetry?
It's Galileo's famous resorting to dialogue is something that he pinched from Bruno. So that what Bruno's doing is much of the time, he wrote a drama trying to present his vision of the world. And if you play it straight, it lasts for 5 hours. And so then he reverted probably more usefully to dialogue, where you can have a drama, but you're not expected to sit in a theater and watch it the whole time. And then his last books about the universe, he actually writes in Latin poetry.
And is this because he was just one of a kind, or did this kind of genre shifting, was that the way it was done?
That's the way it was done. And one of my favorite examples is a chronicle that I've edited by a Sienese chronicler who hates Pope Leo X. And he describes Leo, who's quite corpulent, going out on a hunting expedition and coming back. And he says his face looked like a giant half moon. And then he breaks out into poetry. Oh my God, what a face, and worthy of what a picture. And so poetry is what you use when you need a higher register of expression.
Our mathematicians could learn something from that. Well, to Dilwyn in Pisa, near Pisa, welcome to the show. Why your interest?
Thank you. I'm much less poetic than Ingrid, I'm afraid. I find him a very interesting way to understand how the different currents of Renaissance philosophy and theology and other aspects besides, how their pathology, shall we say, how they can go wrong, and how somebody like Bruno can find out what is wrong about them all and try to compose something out of them that is completely new. That's just me. I just like finding out the reasons why somebody is thinking like they do. And he's a very extreme example of somebody very unconventional, as Ingrid said. And so you learn a lot, not just about him, but about everything that fed into his way of thinking.
Yes, we see him, Giordano Bruno, in stark relief from the society in which he lives. He's the 16th century heretic from Naples who said the universe was infinite. What can you say about that society?
I've been thinking about just that point recently. There is a tendency just to think of him as somebody who expressed very unconventional ideas and was very forthright about it, and then just got what you might call, from the point of view of his contemporaries, his comeuppance at the end. But I don't think that's quite how it works, because he was able to publish his books. Everybody knew his position. Everybody, as it were, who was in a position to put him into a difficult situation, for example, jail or the stake. In the records of his trial, there are numerous instances of people saying, I met him on the street and I chatted with him and he told me these ideas and they were absolutely, you know, rather interesting and this, that and the other. So it wasn't as if everybody looked upon him in kind of horror. It was rather more that they were curious.
And Sean Blanchard, you're a lover of Catholic history. Renaissance history is your passion. This was a time of sailing close to the wind, sometimes crossing into the wind and paying the price, yes?
Yes, certainly. I remember first encountering Bruno the first time I visited Rome. I was very young, undergrad student. I went to see the Pope in St. Peter's give a Wednesday audience, and then I was wandering around Rome, and I ended up in the Campo dei Fiori. And I was struck by this statue. It sort of looked like a Jedi from Star Wars. It was, you know, a man in a cloak, really kind of foreboding and mysterious. And I don't think I knew Bruno's story at the time. I don't think I certainly couldn't have read the Italian inscription. But I remember then learning about the Inquisition during my studies, and obviously one of the most famous victims of the Inquisition being Giordano Bruno. So it's certainly a way that it's a window into kind of intellectual life, scientific learning, literary, philosophical learning is all sort of rolled into one in many of these figures. But studying the Inquisition also can tell us quite a lot about the lives of average people, you know, people who are called up for believing in magic or even sort of deviant sexual practices and all kinds of things. So we have the kind of elite people like Bruno, but we can also learn quite a lot about just everyday life through these really rich Inquisition records.
Now, this is the Roman Inquisition you're referring to, not the Spanish Inquisition.
Yep.
The one led by popes rather than kings.
Yes, yeah, exactly. So the Roman Inquisition is really founded as a kind of really a direct response to the breakdown of dialogue with Protestants. There was this kind of last-ditch effort to sort of heal these growing rifts in Regensburg in 1541, and the Holy Roman Emperor really wanted this to work. It ends up not working. It's rejected by the intransigent party in Rome and also by Martin Luther. So the Pope at the time, Paul III, who was a real kind of sort of had kind of one foot in the Renaissance and one foot in the Counter-Reformation. He's a kind of conflicted figure. He founds the Roman Inquisition in 1542, but it's kind of an updating and a consolidation of these tribunals, which in some cases already exist. So it's really a papal-led Inquisition. It's mostly in Italy, but it does extend sometimes beyond Italy, for example, Malta or Avignon. But this is a very different thing from the Spanish Inquisition and the Portuguese Inquisition, which had been previously founded, and were very much under control of those respective monarchs. So this was very much a kind of church-run Inquisition rather than a state-run Inquisition.
And the fight was Catholic versus Protestant. Ingrid, you say Giordano Bruno, he was excited about his own philosophy because he saw it as a way of mending, of healing this rift.
He's a strange combination of shrewd and totally idealistic. And one of the other people I've worked on is a man named Agostino Chigi, who was the richest man in Europe at the time of the Lutheran Reformation. And since then, I've been following the bankers of that period and realize how much of the Reformation has to do with money, and particularly metal money and where the metal goes. And so for Bruno to try to heal a rift that has deep economic as well as a spiritual basis is inevitably not going to address all of the issues that need to be addressed.
It's like trying to solve a Middle Eastern Iraq war or a Saudi conflict with Iran and thinking only in theological terms, forgetting that oil may have something to do with it.
Yeah, that's the perfect analogy, because it's so complicated. And it turns out that Luther's backers are all people who are financially independent of Jakob Fugger, the banker in Augsburg. All of Luther's opponents owe their position to money forwarded to them from Fugger. And so it's appallingly economic in some ways. And I'm still trying to figure out what that really means.
Fascinating. Appallingly economic. And into this world, Giordano Bruno is born, over 400 years ago in Naples. As a teenager, Ingrid, he enters the Dominicans, the Catholic religious order that had been set up some 300 years earlier. Why did he do this?
He's actually from Nola, which is about 19 kilometers inland from Naples. He can see Vesuvius from his own mountain. And so going to Naples when he's a teenager is a huge social step up. His father was a mercenary soldier in the service of the King of Spain at a time when the whole southern part of Italy is a vice-regal property of the Spanish crown. So it's ruled by a viceroy. Everybody hates them, and his father's working for them. His father is also interested in poetry. And so what you want to do is you have an extremely bright child, and the way to advance the family is to get him to Naples. At that point, the most socially powerful religious establishment in the entire kingdom was the Dominican House, which took in 10 students a year. In Naples, it's where Thomas Aquinas had taught. And so that's where Bruno's family thinks he can really make a reputation, and he does in a number of ways. Interestingly, the year that he goes to join the convent is the year 1563, is the year after the Jesuits put out a little shingle in the center of Naples saying, "Free Latin lessons, inquire within." And I've always thought if he'd gone in that door instead of the door of San Domenico, his life would have been completely different.
Well, to you, Sean, he did take that door. He did become a Dominican friar, not a secluded monk. What did life for a friar look like in the 16th century?
The Dominicans are the order of preachers, so it's kind of in the name itself. They really have a charism or a kind of vocation of teaching that could be catechizing groups of children. It could be giving homilies in churches. It could be teaching in more formal university contexts. So there's a great emphasis on philosophy and on learning. At this point in history, it's really probably the Dominicans and the Jesuits as these leading intellectual orders. How would Bruno's life have been different had he been a Jesuit, I think, is a fascinating question. But the Dominicans are very much looking to Thomas Aquinas, to this great medieval philosopher, theologian. They really base their whole system of viewing the world, their whole metaphysical system, on Thomism, on the philosophy of Thomas Aquinas. So Bruno is joining a paradox in the sense that it's kind of intellectually the cutting edge in a certain sense, but it's also people who are defending an increasingly kind of outdated system of Aristotelianism, and obviously his cantankerous personality. But this was a kind of explosive combination, because the Dominicans were very much ordered towards defending the faith against heresy. This is why they were founded by Saint Dominic. They were called Dominicani, a pun in Latin, the Hounds of the Lord. And I think they come to find Bruno to be a kind of a very different kind of hound, or a very different kind of pit bull in his personality. So this is, I think, from the beginning, an explosive combination.
So these orders were the centers of intellectual excellence and inquiry, but also conformity?
Yeah, I think so. I think it really is kind of a paradox. This is an explosion of learning, of creativity, and intellectual excitement. But there's also this real fear of the destabilizing effects of change, and especially religious change, and that ends up leading to all kinds of repressive practices. So you'll simultaneously have some of the most interesting minds who are themselves inquisitors, which to us seems, you know, completely counterintuitive, but to them in the 16th century, they don't really take a kind of religious idea. Like we will sort of privatize that and say, well, you know, I can go to work and I can have Muslim colleagues, Jewish colleagues, and we can simply disagree privately. We don't have to talk about doctrines that we just collaborate on our mission of education. But in the 16th century, they very much saw all of this together. So a religious challenge was also seen as a kind of social and political challenge. And that's why, unfortunately, some of these creative thinkers like Bruno really just put themselves in the firing line, because their critiques are seen as potentially subversive to all of society, not just someone's, you know, private belief about God or the afterlife or something like that.
And Dilwyn, Sean paints an accurate picture, doesn't he? The boundaries in the 1500s between religion and science, between philosophy and theology, the line between even maths and magic, it just wasn't there and separate like it is now. Help me get into that headspace.
Yes, I must say, Sean said it very eloquently. And I just add to what he said, Bruno was not only a friar, but he was a priest and a licensed theologian. That is, he'd written his, what we would call a PhD nowadays. So he was a very well-trained Dominican theologian, and he continued to express great admiration for Thomas throughout his career. And all of this at the same time that he was explaining it, anybody who believed in what Aristotle said and what the scholastics, Thomas is a scholastic, but the scholastics said was nonsense and ridiculous. So we have a very complicated balancing act to try to understand what Bruno's doing. In a way, what Bruno, I think, really admired was the ability for a human being to say things clearly and philosophically and express themselves in various ways. But he wasn't a mathematician in the sense that Galileo was, or indeed other competent university mathematicians were. And one of the great criticisms that modern scholars who dislike Bruno have is that Bruno didn't know any maths. Well, he did know some maths, but it just wasn't the maths that we would like to call maths at all. Second thing is, he wasn't really an astrologer in the sense that John Dee was, for example, and for a very simple reason. If the universe is infinite, it's got an infinite number of solar systems, Copernican solar systems, and there isn't a superior region as there is in the traditional cosmology, the celestial region with the stars and the planets going around the Earth, which are beaming down their influence, so rather like radioactivity, beaming down their influence into the furnace of the Earth, causing effects down here. If you've got an infinite world, infinite universe, and an infinite number of worlds, that model no longer exists. He didn't have a system of the kind that, again, John Dee would have recognized at all. That does not to say, of course, he didn't believe that there was some celestial influence, but we all do too. I mean, the sun does wake us up in the morning, and other things, and the moon does create tides. So there is some form of influence from the stars or the planets and so on, but not in the sense of astrology working out one's pattern in the future, this, that, and the other.
On ABC Radio National, this is God Forbid. It's the first in a special series of programs on religious rebels. Giordano Bruno, the 16th century heretic from not far from Naples, and our guests, not far from Pisa in Italy, which is also not too far from Naples, is Dilwyn Knox. We also have Ingrid Rowland in Rome and in Perth. Sean Blanchard, I'm James Carlton. Much more ahead. Ingrid Rowland, tell me about the signs that this was a very dangerous man, Giordano Bruno, who needed to be dealt with lest he upset the politics of the day.
He first gets into trouble when he's a novice in the Dominican convent, where, according to reports later to the Inquisition, first he took all the religious images or the images of saints out of his room, saying that intercession of saints wasn't necessary.
But he kept his cross, which meant he still feared and loved God, so to speak.
Yeah, and that's a real Protestant position. And so that must have already alerted people. It also suggests how much in flux everything was in this period, so that it's like early Christianity, where early Christian theology didn't come down on tablets from Mount Sinai. It had to be worked out. And so too, the difference between Catholic theology and Protestant theology had to be worked out. Everything was in flux.
They were Protestants before they knew what a Protestant was.
Yeah, and so there, it's hard to define certain positions when you're in a state of flux. Just as it's a time when they don't even know what they're standing on, because some people think you're standing on a round ball of all the dregs of the universe with crystalline spheres. Bruno has you floating out in an infinite universe, which really scared people. But at this point, all he's saying is, I want only a crucifix. I don't want these images of saints, which is a position being taken within Catholicism. And pretty soon that position is going to be defined as Protestant. He goes up to Rome at one point to perform feats of memory for the Pope and recites Psalm 86 forwards and backwards in Hebrew. And then when he finally takes off into exile, they find out he's been reading Erasmus, and his latrine has got Erasmus books hidden there. So he had no sense that the truth should ever be hooded. The truth should come out, and that people should be able to see the truth when the truth is put before them.
And that's a dangerous idea, certainly then, arguably today, Sean, especially when the truth exposes a lie that powerful people are invested in. So tell me about this and the time of Giordano Bruno. He was saying the universe was infinite, expanding on the Copernican idea that the earth goes round the sun, not the other way around, for which he was mocked.
One of the interesting things for me with kind of studying this from the perspective of the history of the church is sort of trying to trace, like we've talked some about the relationship with Protestantism and how, of course, Bruno's not a Protestant and he actually is excommunicated from, you know, he's cast out from these Protestant communities, which is sort of a claim to fame he has to be cast out of Catholic and Protestant communities in the 16th century. But I think the Copernican, so that, you know, the idea of which now to us is obvious, of course, that the sun is the center of the solar system and not the earth. There was an interesting connection between the Catholic fear of the Protestant Reformation and of all these places, you know, quote unquote, falling to Protestantism. So they rally around a kind of interpretation of the Bible. They talk about the consensus of the fathers. And what they mean is any interpretation of the Bible should not stray from a kind of discoverable consensus of the early interpreters of Christianity. So, for example, if the early church fathers say, you know, when we eat the consecrated bread and drink the wine, this is a real partaking of the body and blood of Jesus, well, then you can't have an interpretation that differs from that, as people like Ulrich Zwingli would have. So regarding Copernicanism, there becomes a fear, and Cardinal Bellarmine, who is involved in the condemnation both of Bruno and of Galileo, he knows that it's theoretically possible that someone could prove the Copernican theory, the heliocentric theory, but he's very nervous that if a view is proven to be scientifically true that clearly contradicts the assumption of these, you know, these men who lived 1,200 years before him, that that would potentially erode confidence in the church as an arbiter of what we would call religious truth. So again, we see that these sort of boundaries where today someone would explain, well, you know, this is the realm of science and Adam and Eve are allegorical, and then this, we have a religious claim about sin or something like that. These boundaries, again, at the time were much, much fuzzier. And you see a kind of awakening of scientific, of the sort of scientific worldview that we have today, but it's still, they're still very nervous about unless this can be conclusively demonstrated it would be better to simply leave it aside and to not add to the very, very rapid amount of change and what they would see as confusion in the world today. So that definitely looks to us like an intellectually cowardly position. But I think we do have to try to enter into just a profoundly different worldview about authority and about society and kind of the rate of change that society can handle.
And Ingrid, Giordano Bruno, he didn't really care about the rate of change society could handle or didn't appear to. He was on this quest for religious, spiritual, scientific truth, and it took him to Geneva and beyond, France.
Yes, because he gets in trouble in Naples because he opens his mouth one time too many, and then he's up in Rome at Santa Maria Sopra Minerva, the Dominican convent in the center of Rome where Galileo would eventually be tried. He finds out that they've found his Erasmus books in the latrine in Naples. Erasmus was banned, and so the only job Bruno can get is tutoring mathematics to rich kids north of Genoa. He goes to Venice at some point and wanders around northern Italy and finally ends up in Geneva thinking maybe the Calvinists have an answer. And that doesn't work either because he decides that one of the lecturers he hears is uninformed. He publishes a series of corrections to the lecturer's lecture, and that doesn't go over well. And it's just one thing after another. He has this acute critical sense, and he can't quite understand why other people don't follow him. But most people are terrified with this almost lizard brain terror of being on a ball hurtling through the universe among all these other balls. It's just more than the average person can possibly take.
To Bruno, the idea of the Earth moving through the solar system this way is normal and natural. To the rest of the world, it's petrifying, and he just can't understand why. And if we fast forward to the moment of his execution, he thought, but everyone misunderstands me, so I know what I'll do. I'll give my entire volume of work to the Pope. He'll read it all, see that I was right, and then get me off. We saw how that ended up. He burnt to death, but we will get to that later in the show. To you, Dilwyn, now, spoiler alert, I should have said. Giordano Bruno, he ends up in France, then ends up in England. He's obviously got a Eurorail ticket of some kind. What happens there?
He went to Toulouse. He found what we would now call a kind of temporary teaching position at Toulouse University, teaching Aristotle.
What was it that Aristotle thought, and what was it that Bruno disagreed with?
I think the answer to the question is more or less anything that Aristotle said was wrong. So you'd have to go back to understanding his theology, in that he believed that the universe was the manifestation of a supreme principle, God, you might want to call it. As such, it must be infinite. That's the crucial step.
An infinite God is consistent with an infinite universe.
Yes, and it was nonsense to think that God would make a little pot when he could make something infinite.
And the existing mainstream thinking was a little God made a little pot, to be flippant.
Yes, well, that's how he would have said it. Well, he did more or less say exactly that, in fact, yes. So if you start from that principle, then it's obviously nonsense to talk about a finite cosmos. And if you've removed the idea of a finite cosmos, you've removed all of Aristotle's physics. And if you've removed all of his physics, you've removed more or less everything else too. It's that sequence of thought that means he disagrees with everything Aristotle says. That's not to say that everything that is in Aristotle's books is wrong, because occasionally, Aristotle did get a few things correct. But that was only because he was plagiarizing people who had written and said things before him. So Aristotle is well known for summarizing the views of what we would call pre-Socratic thinkers, philosophers, people like Democritus and people of this kind, Aristotle would, according to Bruno, steal some of the ideas and just include them. And that's why you can find good things in Aristotle. But Aristotle was a system is completely wrong. There are other things as well, but I think that's probably enough to understand why he disliked Aristotle, while all the time being a very competent teacher, not only in France, but also when he comes to Germany. He is hired as a lecturer in Aristotelian philosophy of one kind or another.
Sean Blanchard, he sounds like, from a student's perspective, a very exciting lecturer. From a university administrator's perspective, the worst nightmare you could imagine.
Yeah, I completely agree. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think strategically, it's just not the time to be doing this, I think, for Bruno. I mean, it's amazing. I know that the sort of mindset that Ingrid and Dylan have described, if I can just get the Pope to actually read all of my arguments, or if I can just explain to everyone all of these arguments. I mean, you do get these figures kind of dotted through the 15th and 16th century, and it often ends very poorly for them.
And hindsight, you feel sorry for them because it presupposes that even if the Pope got the book, that he would understand it.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Because it just looks hopeless for some of these very, very, very daring thinkers. I mean, even Martin Luther kept saying, well, if the Pope was just informed correctly about what I'm actually saying, then he would agree with me. I mean, this is basically what he claims to some of his opponents in Germany. So we know how the story ends, and it's in some ways these are very, very sad episodes. But in other ways, you know, this is laying the ground for really, really important debates about astronomy, about physics, about faith and reason, religion and science. So I mean, we do have to even if we disagree with some of Bruno's religious conclusions, I think we do have to admire pushing the argument forward and really forcing it. Like I think it's healthy for the church to have to confront, you know, serious, interesting intellectual challenges. And when we don't do that, you know, speaking as a Catholic theologian, I think that things really atrophy and we can kind of turn in ourselves and not grow. So I would have to sort of admire the kind of provocative spirit in Bruno.
Ingrid, what is the next bridge crossed and bridge burned on the way to his ultimate burning at the stake in Italy? That was his final fatal error, was to return to Italy.
Yes, when he could have probably had a decent life in Zurich, he went back to Venice invited by a nobleman who wanted to learn the art of memory. Bruno was a particularly expert practitioner in something that many scholars and even lay people were doing in the 16th and 17th centuries, where what you would do is memorize a speech or even, say, take in something that you're reading by associating parts of the written or spoken text with visual images. And so you could do this with a structure like a building. I did a lot of slide lecturing in my career, and basically that was the art of memory, where I hooked each section of a class or a lecture to a particular image. And so it's a natural way for human beings to learn. But people like Bruno could take this to an extraordinary length. Aquinas was another practitioner of this art, and he could dictate four different books to four different secretaries at the same time, keeping each one of these that he could compartmentalize. And so basically, the art of memory is this megagalactic compartmentalization of information on an extraordinary scale that you can do if you learn it when you're young. Apparently, if you're older than 17, forget it, because your brain's frozen in certain ways. And I've tried it with undergraduates. I could get freshmen to do it. I couldn't get older students to do it because you're not pliable in the same way. You have better analytical skills, but the price is the vacuuming up of information goes by the board. This Venetian wasn't interested in discipline. He was a Venetian aristocrat. He was basically a notorious crank. And one night he got really angry and he wrote a denunciation of Bruno to the Inquisition. The letter is still there. And he's so angry that the pen's scoring the page. He practically takes the point of his quill and is penetrating the paper itself with his rage. And in a fit of pique, he said this, and he said that, and sends it to the Inquisition. And the problem is, once you have a letter of denunciation to the Inquisition, that letter is the basis for the entire subsequent trial. That letter sends a mechanism into motion, which started with Mocenigo, this disgruntled noble, locking Bruno in the attic and waiting till the police come. The police take Bruno off to inquisitorial prison, start interrogating him, and that makes the whole business go forward. Later, it will transpire. There are two witnesses. They finally get a cellmate of Bruno and Mocenigo. By the time Bruno goes to trial, Mocenigo has made a million denunciations of everything to every authority because he's a crank. And the other witness in Bruno's trial ends up at the stake himself after being certified as insane. So that you have two witnesses, one's a crank and one's insane, but that has nothing to do with the juggernaut of the law. The law goes forward because if the law doesn't go forward, we all who believe in the rule of law think the entire structure will collapse. And so Bruno gets crunched really because Mr. Mocenigo's angry. I think it's because he was undisciplined. The Mocenigo family says it's because Bruno made a pass at Mocenigo's wife.
Oh, dear. On Radio National, this is, God forbid, a special series on the great religious rebels of our time. It seems not just turning against God, but turning against the lover of the powerful can also do this to you. We're with Ingrid Rowland, we're with Dilwyn Knox, and we're with Sean Blanchard. So he's in prison, Giordano Bruno. Dilwyn Knox, tell me what happens in his final days.
Well, could I disobey orders and just explain what happened before his final days? Because he's not in Rome, he's in Venice, and he's tried, and it's a very long and bureaucratic process. But the interesting thing is that it's really not going anywhere until at a certain moment the Roman Inquisition hears that they've got hold of this renegade Dominican who's been on the wanted list for a long time, and they demand his extradition to Rome. And Venice, because Venice is Venice and doesn't really like doing what it's told by the papacy. It's a republic and thinks of itself and as in charge of its own matters. Thank you very much. We don't necessarily have to do what His Holiness says. Resist for quite a long time. But for reasons that are not entirely clear, maybe there's some bargaining going on, they eventually release him and he's transferred across the Po in a boat, rather like Charon's boat in some ways, and taken down to Rome where the trial again goes on in a very desultory way for a long time. The main problem being that they don't really have many of his books. And so they don't really know what he's saying. And up until this point, from what records we still do have, and I must stress, we don't really have that much. We have summaries, we have some documents, but we don't have kind of the full transcripts of it or anything of that kind. But it seemed they didn't really have many books, and Bruno knew this, and so he was kind of explaining as much as he could of what they already knew, but in a way that didn't get him into too much trouble and not mentioning some of the things he had said in other books. The real problem in his position was that he denied the existence of miracles, not just miracles that happen every day, but also, of course, Jesus's and the divinity of Christ. And that really was a problem. But, you know, he would say, well, I'm just a philosopher. I'm just explaining my philosophical point of view. Of course, I'm a good Catholic, and I believe what the Catholic Church demands me to say. He says this at one point, much to the dismay of 19th century historians who admired Bruno, wanted to present him as a great free thinker who was standing up to the church. But Bruno was looking after himself at that point reasonably well. But then our friend Roberto Bellarmino turns up, who we've mentioned before, and knows how to run an Inquisition properly, and demands that all of the books of Bruno are traced in some form or another. And once that is done, they've got a good view of what Bruno was up to and what he was saying. Bruno, at this point, he's being treated, the word Inquisition gives a very dire impression of the institution, but you were kept, by the standards of the time, in a reasonably good way. He had implements to write with, he had a razor, he had daily access to some form of bathing, and he was, I think, had one glass of red wine a day, I think it was. It was a regime that was meant that you could continue to live as a decent human being could live. You weren't always necessarily tortured, although it's believed that Bruno was once or twice tortured to get the truth out of him. But there wasn't really much need to torture Bruno to get the truth out, because he's very happy to tell everybody what he thought. So the game that seems to have gone on with the Inquisition was this, that they would interrogate him. They would explain to him that this is not an acceptable point of view to have. And he would say, yes, I know it's not, because the Holy Church requires me to believe in this or that. And then he would go away to his cell and start writing, with the pen that he was allowed to have, an explanation of why his view wasn't incompatible with what they had said, or perhaps they might want to think about what they had said, and send it back to them and say, having thought about it, I'm not entirely sure that I can agree to saying that I was wrong about this matter. And this went on and on and on and on. And eventually, the Inquisition just lost it. We have to remember that Bruno is being tried not just by some kind of bureaucratic body. The chair of the commission at certain points was the Pope himself. So you had to get some very important people to find time in their diary to sit down and listen to this, obviously slightly mad man talking about daft things, and then come to an agreement, and then have to read some more stuff from him saying that he wasn't wrong after all. And this just went, repeated itself, this pattern repeated itself, until finally the Pope received the latest document from Bruno explaining why he was not going to agree to say that he was wrong about something, and the Pope refused to open it and said no. So this man is now going to be condemned as an impenitent heretic. And then the process, the machinery then, a different type of machinery then starts to take over.
Well, Sean Blanchard, that machinery from there is his execution, his last words. Perhaps, I don't know if it's true, he says, perhaps you who pronounce my sentence are in greater fear than I who receive it.
Yes. I mean, it's interesting to the kind of the comparisons with Galileo. So you have this like an incredibly defiant Bruno at the last moment here. He's brought to the Campo di Fiore, and he's in some way prevented from speaking. There's different accounts of what exactly they did of gagging him or putting device on his tongue or something like that. He allegedly refuses obstinately to look at the crucifix that is kind of offered to him as a sort of last chance of penitence and saving his soul, and he's burned. But it's interesting with these last words that are reported, and again the proper Bruno biographers here can tell us the chance that this is or isn't apocryphal. And to compare that with Galileo, I find really interesting, because Galileo, this is apocryphal. There's no evidence he actually said this. But when Bellarmine, the same cardinal who was on the committee condemning Bruno, condemns Galileo, and he allegedly says, and yet it still moves under his breath. oh, yes, of course. And, he affirms a kind of geocentric, and I won't speak anymore about this. And then he allegedly muttered, eper si muove, and yet it still moves. So that you have this kind of like cheeky wink, wink defiance sort of from Galileo. Look, I'll pay lip service to what you're telling me to say, but we kind of, people are going to increasingly figure out that I'm right, which is, of course, what ultimately happens in the case of Galileo. But with Bruno, there's this sort of profound challenge to an institution and to kind of a way of regulating life and regulating conscience and debate. And I think that's probably why the legacy of Bruno is different from Galileo. And he comes to be seen as a kind of, I don't want to say anti-religious symbol, because I mean, I'm sure he is that for some people, but it's really a kind of anti-clerical or anti-institutional religion symbol. And this is, I think, plays out in the Bruno statue. So if anyone's ever visiting in Rome, you know, look at the statue, read it. There's these little medallions around it that depict various figures who are not necessarily anti-Christian. I mean, some of them are Christian reformers, John Wycliffe, Paolo Sarpi from Venice, Jan Hus, but they're people who sort of defied a kind of authoritarian structure. So I think that's really the way to remember Bruno is, again, he's not, I don't even see him, at least certainly not from our 21st century perspective, as necessarily, certainly not anti-spiritual, anti-religious per se, but it's a very, very powerful challenge to institutional religion and to what he saw as a kind of coercion of his freedom of thought and his conscience.
Mm. Is that what you see as his legacy to Ingrid Roland? And what would you say if he was somehow here next to you?
Yeah, I think his legacy has yet really to be assessed correctly, because there are a lot of ideas that Galileo and Kepler, for example, take from him that modern historians of science don't quite acknowledge, because he's using numerology rather than calculation. And I have my own feelings about the conservatism of history of science, because it tends to impose a kind of conformity in teleology, as if you say history of science, then you've already presupposed that what all these thinkers are supposed to have been doing is paving the way for science as defined by historians of science, rather than trying to move forward with thought. And so I think his scientific importance has been very much downplayed.
Because he was interested in the occult, and modern science lovers don't want to be tarnished with that. So even though he was this pioneer theologically and scientifically, it still carries that stain.
Yeah, that's perfect. That really describes what the issue is. If I ran into him, I think we'd have a great time, because in many ways, I think I'm a lot like him.
Dilwyn Knox, his legacy and your words to him if he were with us.
Yes, well, his he did have a wonderful legacy in the late 18th and 19th century. He was at one point not far off being in the same league as Spinoza. He was seen as the St. John the Baptist of Spinoza by all of the great German thinkers.
That's a Baruch Spinoza, the Jewish thinker.
Yes, exactly. There was also kind of a pantheist. I know the word, we mustn't start using that word, otherwise it gets complicated. But every single one of them, and including people like Coleridge in England, thought of him as a magnificent figure and as a truly religious man, because he had this religious view of the world, of the universe, but it just wasn't one that conformed to the, now, by then, obviously, very outmoded Aristotelian scholastic model. So he did have a great legacy at that point, but it's then the various other Brunos have kind of taken over from then. There's Bruno the nationalist hero, Bruno the magician, but I'm not really a supporter of that idea. I don't think he was really interested. Magic is not what we call magic at all. It just means ideas that don't conform to what we call science, rather than something that is to do with the occult and raising spirits and so forth. If I had one thing I wanted to say to him, I've said this to myself every day when I wake up, please, Giordano, could you please just sit down and write 2 books, 100 pages each, explaining your philosophy in a systematic way? Because he wrote more than 45 books, and that was in less than 9 years. I mean, because he wrote at such speed, his ideas are just tumbling out all over the place, and it's really quite difficult sometimes to put A and B and C and D together to understand exactly what he's saying. But if you take the trouble, there is always a consistent pattern. And I'd say to him, look, if you want to make sure that everybody understands what you're talking about, could you just write it down in a nice, simple way so that we can all understand it and so that I don't have to sit here day after day trying to work it all out?
Last word to you, Sean Blanchard. And Dilwyn hasn't even included in that list the lost work of...
Yes.
What was it called? On the Signs of the Times. We know it was written, but we've never discovered it.
Mm. Well, if Bruno sort of magically appeared in front of me, I would try to get him to Oxford and organize an Oxford Union debate between him, Richard Dawkins, and Rowan Williams, former Archbishop of Canterbury, because I think that would be a wonderful thing to see. But I, you know, I'd be fascinated just to know how would he receive and evaluate the developments in philosophy since his death. If he could read the work of Spinoza, would he see himself as in continuity, as a kind of forerunner of this sort of radical Enlightenment thought? And I would also tell him that the church formally apologized for burning Jan Hus and has rehabilitated Galileo, but has only said that his own execution was unfortunate. So I would love to speak with him about the various anniversaries of his death. So the 400th anniversary of his death, Angelo Sedano, Cardinal Sedano, who was the Secretary of State, he apologized for the execution of Bruno, but he certainly didn't sort of attempt to rehabilitate him in the same sense that Galileo was rehabilitated in a kind of quasi-official way. So I think he would probably find that interesting or amusing.
Well, it's the 425th anniversary. Maybe that's another opportunity for the church to reconsider.
There we go. We can Ingrid can put it before the Pope next time she sees him.
Give him my best. And my best to you three. Thank you so much for being on this special series on religious rebels. For God forbid, it's been a great pleasure having you, Ingrid, Dilwyn, and Sean. Thank you, Ingrid.
Thank you. This was so much fun.
Ingrid Rowland, an author, essayist, emeritus professor of antiquity and Renaissance history at the U.S. University of Notre Dame, though Ingrid's based in Rome. Her dozen books include Giordano Bruno, Philosopher, Heretic. Dilwyn Knox, thank you for being with us not far from Pisa in Italy.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dilwyn is emeritus professor of Renaissance studies at University College London. He's the author of some two dozen books and chapters on the Renaissance, including the philosophy of Bruno. And Sean Blanchard, thank you so much from Perth.
Thank you, James, and thank you, Ingrid and Dilwyn. It's a real pleasure.
Sean's lecture in theology at the Fremantle campus of the University of Notre Dame, Australia. His anticipated fifth book, Catholicism and Enlightenment, to be published by Cambridge University Press. Thank you very much to our producer, Amanda Roberts. You can follow and share the God Forbid podcast and check out this series on ABC Listen, plus the God Forbid Radio National ABC website. All the details are there. You can email me at godforbid@abc.net.au. I'm James Carlton. This has been God Forbid. Until our next episode of Religious Rebels, remember to be good and defiantly faithful, at least. This has been God Forbid.
Listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.